This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, nice to see you. It's time for the most mind-melting part of your week. This is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. It's the show where we take a trip to the most dangerous and deadly part of the universe and get you back within about half an hour. Now this week, we're meeting the stinkiest fruit in the world. Also, we'll have a look at the fattest species of parrot, and we'll take a peek inside the night sky. I need to answer some of your questions, so if you've said hello over on Apple Podcasts, stick around. I might say hello back in a sec. First, let's help our alien friends get back home. This is NNG.
NNG's Meet a Motivator.
So, guys, you know all about energy, right?
No, we are energy.
Solar system specialists, no less. So, what's up?
Well, I'm on a mission to find out more. I know that energy we use in our homes comes through meters that you have to read. I mean, how do you read energy? It's not like it's a book. And where does the energy even come from?
Well, that's an easy one. Come on, let's see where it all starts.
We're deep under your Earth's surface. This is where energy companies drill thousands of feet down to reach reserves of natural gas. Gas is one kind of energy that's used to heat your cozy habitats and cooking appliances.
Once extracted, it is stored until needed and then delivered to homes, factories, schools, hospitals, you name it, through a network of pipes known as the gas mains. These pipes connect to your home through a meter that measures how much gas is being used.
Kind of like a turnstile, clicking each time more gas goes through.
Totally. And electricity is just the same. Every time you flip a switch or plug in a device, it's there. And like gas, it's come a long way.
Electricity is made at power stations by huge generators. Most power stations today use gas or nuclear to fuel the generators. But some use wood, and obviously wind and water can be used to generate electricity.
The electricity is distributed through a network of cables called the National Grid. You'll have seen the huge pylons that crisscross the country. Smaller wires under pavements carry electricity into your homes. And just like gas, there's a meter to check how much is being used so your gran gets the right bill.
So, let me get this straight. Meters are machines that measure how much gas and electricity are used so energy companies can make sure you're charged the right amount.
Exactly. Let's take a look for ourselves. Now, where could they be?
Hey, this is my gran's house. Her electricity meter is under the stairs.
Wow! It's darker than the gloom caverns of Mordulus Infernal in here.
Let me throw some light on the situation.
So, yeah, look up there. That's the electricity meter. I can see there's a dial that's turning quite quickly, probably because the lights are on and Gran's got supper cooking. There are also numbers to read. No wonder Granny has to stand on a chair to read the numbers.
Galactic goblins, that doesn't sound safe.
And her gas meter is outside, by the front door in its own little box. It also has numbers that Gran has to write down.
Knowing about how we measure energy is the first stage to becoming a marvellous meter motivator. And being a meter motivator is great to help people around you, like your Gran.
Watch out. Looks like we're gonna fuse, G. Time for us to pop.
Here it comes. Whoopee! I love a bit of fusion.
Bye, NNG, and thanks.
Here it comes.
Find out how you can be a meter motivator with NNG. With support from Smart Energy GB. Find out more at funkinslide.com/energy.
So, if you've got some sciencey questions doing laps and laps and laps around your brain, shout them over to me. Let me try and answer them for you. Either I'll sort an expert, a proper genius in that field, to let you know the answer, or I will trawl through the dusty, musty libraries near where I live and get the answer myself. All you need to do to get in touch is to leave it as a review over on Apple Podcasts. And we've had a whole load pop up on there recently. I really love checking it every day, seeing who said hello, where you're from, and I'll get round to finding answers to most of you, hopefully, in good time. But very quickly, thank you to Martin Brown and to Super Wheels Nat and to William in Birmingham as well for your 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts. Really appreciate it, guys. Thank you. Now, this question is from Jack. Hello, Jack. You are 10 years old. You're from Hertfordshire. and you ask, why is seawater salty and why are rivers fresh? Well, seawater is salty, Jack, because of all the rocks and the sediment that's around, that's under the ocean, that's around beaches as well. And as the sea washes around, it picks up the salt from them. And when that seawater gets hot, it evaporates and it rises up through the sky as a gas, and then it becomes cold, so it condenses into a cloud. Then the clouds travel over land, then they rain. And it's that rainwater that makes rivers and lakes. And it's fresh because when seawater evaporates, it leaves the salt behind. That's part of the science of evaporation. It doesn't take the salt with it. So that is why fresh water is rained onto the earth. Thanks for the question. Also, this is from Jammy 2007. Catchy name. Who asks, how do sharks sense prey around them? Well, Jammy 2007, it's because they've got a keen sense of smell, and it's because blood is quite pungent when it's in the water, so they can sniff out a tiny drop of the red stuff from miles away. They also use sight, and they use ears to detect prey. They listen out for low frequency, irregular sounds, perhaps a struggling fish thrashing about, so it knows it's got dinner just around the corner. Also, they use sensory receptors that run along the sides of their body, and with these they can pick up pulses and vibration that's in the water to let them know that there's food nearby. Really quite simple. Brilliantly smart from sharks. Just an utter killing machine. Thanks for getting in touch, Jammy. If you've got a question that you want answered on this show, you need to leave it for me as a review over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, Sunday the 14th of April is International Look Up at the Stars Day, where wherever you are in the world, you're encouraged to stare into space at night and try and find something amazing while you're up there. So I thought it was quite a good idea to learn more about them. Mark Thompson is an astronomer. He's a co-host on Stargazing Live on the telly, and he's on the phone. Hey, Mark.
How are you, sir?
I'm really well. And Mark, I wanted to start. What's the most obvious constellation that we can see? First thing that our eyes are going to be drawn to into the sky?
Yeah, it's just really difficult. If you look at the night sky on any time of the year, then it's really difficult to find anything. I'll say that straight away. So even some of the really easy constellations to find can still be a little bit of a challenge. But probably the best one to start with is the Plough. Now, the Plough is actually a group of stars which looks like a saucepan with a bent handle. That's the best way to describe it. And the really great thing about it is it's visible all year round. Some of the constellations rise and set at different times of the year. So some you can see in the summer, some you can see in the winter, but the Plough is there all year round from the UK, and you will always see it in the northern part of the sky. So you've got to look out for this large saucepan shape with a bent handle.
Now, are there any stars in the sky, and I've got a feeling the Plough might be almost one of these, that are kind of indicators to where other constellations might be? If we find the Plough, is it then quite easy for us to find other constellations around it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great technique that certainly amateur astronomers, so people who do astronomy for a hobby, will use to find the way around the sky. You start off with something that's big and bright and easy to find, like the Plough, and then you do this thing called star hopping, and you use it a bit like a signpost to other objects around the sky. And you can use it to find planets, you can use it to find other constellations and other stars. And in fact, navigators use the Plough to find the north, so you can actually use it to find direction as well. So if you find the constellation, or the shape of stars called the Plough, then if you take the first two stars in sort of the bowl of the saucepan shape and follow them up, you follow them away from the saucepan, they will take you to the North Pole star, and that star never moves in the sky and is always due north. So if you ever lost, you can find where you are, or you need to find the direction of north using the Plough.
Why does that never move? Is it moving with us?
No. So you've got to think about the fact that the Earth is like a whacking great ball. So there's a big sphere, and it spins on its axis. Now, a bit like a spinning top, you can imagine what a spinning top is like, as it spins really, really fast. Now, a spinning top has got a big chunk of metal through it that the spinning top spins around. And the Earth, in the same way, spins on an axis. And that axis, if you followed the line that the Earth spins around, if you follow that up to the sky, then that points directly to the North Pole star at the moment. It does move over thousands and thousands of years, but actually, for our intents and purposes, it doesn't move at all, because, you know, it takes a lot of years to move. So it's because the Earth is spinning and the axis that the Earth spins around points directly to that star. And it's the spinning of the Earth which make things look like they're moving in the sky. So fortunately, there's a nice bright star where that axis points, and that shows us where the direction of north is.
Mark, how long have you been stargazing?
A lot of years. I actually started stargazing when I was about 10 years old. So my dad took me along to my local astronomy club, and I saw Saturn through a telescope, and that got me really excited and really hooked about astronomy and stargazing. And ever since then, you know, it's taken me on quite a crazy journey through many long nights of staying awake. That's the great thing about astronomy; it means you can stay up late, which is superb. But yes, I've done stargazing now for probably a good 30 odd years.
Now, the reason I asked that, and thank you for mentioning 30 odd years, which means, you know, you've been doing this for so long, and you mentioned earlier on that the plough's one of the easiest constellations to find. What about the opposite of that? What's one of the hardest that we can find? Are there still constellations that you're searching for 30 years into your stargazing journey?
No, do you know, I think I've seen everything. There's actually a fairly small number of constellations in the sky, so groupings of stars that you can see. And yeah, some of them are really obscure and really difficult to find. And I think I've probably seen most of them. But there are, I mean, there's galaxies and star clusters and objects which are really faint, and they take telescopes to be able to see them. And I, you know, I've not even scratched the surface yet. There are so many of them that I've just not seen yet. And that's, you know, that's the great thing about stargazing, is that there's stuff for everyone to do, whatever your level of interest, and it will keep you going for years and years and years.
If I were to look up at the sky and see Orion's Belt, for instance, I could, you know, look up and I could measure it, the distance between the three of them, with a finger width almost.
Yeah.
How far is between these constellations actually up in space? What are we talking about in light years or in miles?
Oh, crikey. So it depends. So you're absolutely right. So as astronomers, we don't measure the distance to stars in miles and kilometres, because the numbers are just far too big. Now, the Sun is a star, and that's the nearest star to the Earth. But even though the distances are so big, we actually use something called light years to measure, or to explain how far away things are. So we use the speed of light, so the light travels 300,000 kilometres every second. And if you could get in your car and drive 300,000 kilometres a second for a year, then that's the distance of one light year. Now, if you forget the Sun, which is our nearest star, then the nearest star to our solar system is a star called Proxima Centauri. And travelling at the speed of light, so travelling at 300,000 kilometres every second, you would have to travel for just over 4 years to get to it. Which makes you realise these things are a long way. And that's the nearest one. There are stars in our galaxy which are thousands of light years away, hundreds of thousands of light years away. But there are stars in other galaxies that are millions of light years away. So there's some things we can look at through telescopes, even through fairly simple telescopes, that they're so far away from us that the light left before the Earth was even here. So you're actually looking back in time, which is quite a crazy idea.
Well, I know that when you look at the Sun, even though you're not meant to, you are seeing 8 minutes into the
past. Yeah, just over 8 minutes ago.
So,
that's right, yeah.
You're talking about the distance between us and stars. What about the distance between two stars in a constellation to each other? Is that still a whacking great amount?
It's still a whacking great distance. And you've got to think that actually the stars look like they're close to each other, but actually one star could be quite close to you, but there could be another star that's a long way away from you, but is still in the same direction. So they look like they're side by side, but actually there could be thousands of light years between them. So the stars in Orion's Belt, for example, there are thousands of light years between them, even though they look like they're really close together in the sky.
Now, where I'm talking to you right now, I'm in the UK. But if I were to go to the other side of the world, to somewhere like Australia, how much of a different stars in the night sky would I see there?
Yeah, I mean, if you went to the other side of the Earth from where you are now, then you would see a different set of stars. I mentioned earlier that the Earth is a ball, shaped like a ball. And if you can imagine you're sat on the surface of a ball and you look up away from the surface of the ball, then you'll look in one direction. You can try it yourselves. You get, you know, get a football or a netball or something, get a ball, hold it in your hand and imagine standing on the surface of the ball and looking away from it. You'd look to one side of your room, but if you stood on the other side of the ball, looked in the other direction, you see the other side of your room. And that's the same in space. So we stand on different parts of the surface of the Earth, which is a ball, and we see out and we're looking out in different directions in space. So we'll see one set of constellations from here in the UK, and we'll see a different set of constellations from somewhere like Australia. And depending on where you are, you might see a mixture of the two. But if, for example, you're still on the North Pole of the Earth, you would never see the stars that you could see if you stood on the South Pole of the Earth. So it depends where you are as to which ones you'll see, but certainly there will be some constellations which you'll never see from both locations.
We've got a North Pole star. Is there a South Pole star?
Do you know, there isn't. That's a really good question. We're very lucky because we've got a fairly bright, easy to find star called Polaris, where the North Pole is. But actually, if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, the best you've got is a constellation called Crux, spelled C-R-U-X, the Southern Cross. And that's kind of close to the Southern Pole, but it's not as good as ours. We've got the better one.
Now, to go inside with International Lookup at the Stars Day, Alton Towers Resort in the UK have thankfully made it quite easy for us, Mark. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah, do you know, they've created the most wonderful, charming little lodges that you can stay in called stargazing pods. Now, they've made about 102 of these stargazing pods, which, wonderfully, they're made out of wood as well. And I think it's something so lovely about being out in nature, because, you know, the night sky is a natural wonder. It's something you can appreciate as a natural thing. And to be staying in these things called stargazing pods, which are made of wood, which are also very natural, is a lovely experience. They've got these wonderful stargazing pods, and you can go there with your family. You can have your mum and dad, and they sleep four people, so you can go there as a family and experience the night sky. And it's a great location away from lights, and you can actually get out there and do some stargazing while going somewhere exciting like Alton Towers.
Amazing. Give that a search online. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we have a look at the meanest and some of the strangest things that are in the world. And today we've got a very peculiar one, because it's not deadly as such, but it is probably something that you don't want anywhere near you. You need to meet the durian. It's the world's smelliest fruit. This stinker is covered in a hard shell, which is prickly, it's really spiky, and then they're massive too. Durians can grow up to the size of a football, weighing up to 4 kilograms, and their stench has been compared to a blend of flowers, rotten onions, sweaty pants, petrol, custard, cheese, eggs, and of course, nothing's ever going to be disgusting without this word, poo. Rancid poo, that's what the durian can smell like. Now, once you break through the tough husk, you'll find some fleshy pulp in there that's ripe to be eaten. And there are some seeds too. And here, actually, things do get dangerous because the seeds are toxic. They're poisonous to humans if they're not cooked properly. They're filled with a fatty acid that we can't deal with. And that makes it dangerous. This fruit, it divides a lot of people as well. You see, in Southeast Asia, some call the durian the king of the fruits. They think it's delicious and creamy and sweet and rich. Others detest it. The durian is so stinking as well that it's banned from many public spaces in Thailand. And in Singapore, it's even illegal to carry them on public transport. And if anything's illegal, it surely earns a place on our Dangerous Dan list. Very quickly, let me interrupt the usual timeline of this show with some brilliant news, because the Fun Kids Science Weekly, this thing right here, right now, it's been nominated for 2 British Podcast Awards. We're up for Best Radio and Best Family in the awards. That's all decided by judges. There's nothing really that we can do about that. But there is one other prize that they do that you can help me win. You see, there is a Listener's Choice Award, and it's voted for by listeners and by fans. I hope, I really, really hope that's you. And the podcast with the most votes gets the prize. So if you love what we do, if you really love listening to the show every single week, if you love learning about science, if you think it's made your brain bulge, it's made you get loads smarter, made you learn loads more about the world around you, and if you really enjoy hearing from the experts and all the geniuses and the astronauts that we manage to get on the show, well, do us a favour. It's dead easy. It takes barely 2 seconds of your day. Head over to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and search for the Fun Kids Science Weekly, and then give us a quick vote. It's honestly that simple, takes barely a minute, and you could help us win an actual prize, the Listener's Choice British Podcast Awards. Do it, please. I hope it's nice and gold and shiny, you know. Right, it's time to get some of your geeky questions answered. This is our gadget guru, Technomum.
Technomum, engineering explorers.
Tidying my room is so boring. Picking everything up and putting it away, or throwing it away. Yuck! How long has that banana skin been there?
How are you getting on? I bought the vacuum cleaner up. I only hope it's strong enough to cope.
Never mind the hoovering. Why can't someone invent a machine to do all the tidying?
Maybe you could invent one yourself. It's a real job, you know, making new machines.
You mean I could be a robotic slave overlord, creating an army of mechanoids to do my bidding?
I mean you could be a mechanical engineer. It's a type of engineering which is almost as old as humans.
Are you sure about that, Mum? I don't think cavemen had vacuum cleaners.
Machinery is anything which does a job. Even creating a spear is engineering. Hang on, I'll explain. All machines have something in common. Like I say, they're designed to do a job. Maybe the job is to vacuum the carpet. Perhaps it's to screw a light bulb into a street lamp or assemble a mobile phone in a factory. Whatever it is, mechanical engineers design, produce and operate machinery to carry out the work.
So, mechanical engineers are kind of like inventors?
Sometimes, yes. Other times they'll be helping an inventor to create their machine. Mechanical engineers understand the science behind movement and understand the properties of different materials. They also have to understand how the environment around a machine will affect things. Heat or cold can change how materials behave, so a machine which is working with molten steel might have to be built of metals which can withstand hot temperatures. Or if a machine is part of a marine expedition, it'll need to be able to function in water and cope with high pressures.
And they'll have to build it out of a material that doesn't rust.
That's right. Machines sent into space have to be built to withstand extremes of temperature and a lot of radiation. And as there aren't any petrol stations in space, their power supplies have to be carefully designed to use what solar power they can gather. As you can see, different machines have different demands.
Sounds like there's a lot to learn about.
Yes, and it's a job which overlaps with lots of other types of engineering. Mechanical engineers often need to know computer programming, or how chemicals behave, how things fly or swim, or what keeps structures stable. The possibility for creating amazing new machinery is astounding. Check out this video.
Cool robot. What's it doing?
This is STAR, Smart Tissue Autonomous Robot. It's a robot surgeon that's more accurate than a human when making incisions or stitching up tissue. Or how about Zhao Yi, a robot doctor? Scientists have uploaded hundreds of medical textbooks into its databanks, and it's programmed to ask questions. Engineers behind these medical robots will have had to spend a long time designing the robotic system, choosing materials and tools with which to build them, and then carrying out lots of tests, making changes when things didn't work as planned. All that hard work has been worth it. These are machines that might help to save lives.
That's so cool!
There are stacks of cool engineering jobs out there, almost as many as the stacks of comics under your bed. Are you sure you need to keep them all?
Mum!
Engineering Explorers, created with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology to celebrate the Year of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/technomum.
Let's hear about all the science that has been in your news this week then. Ancestors of the people who built Stonehenge travelled from the east across the Mediterranean before reaching Britain, a study has recently found. You know Stonehenge, that's the huge rock formation in the UK? Well, it's baffled scientists for ages. Now they think it was built in around 3000 BC. That's 5000 years ago. And DNA has been extracted from Neolithic human remains nearby, and after studying it, scientists think that those people came from Turkey that the bones belong to. So the mystery gets even deeper. Also, kakapos, which is the world's fattest species of parrot, they've had their most successful breeding season on record, according to New Zealand's Department of Conservation. The flightless nocturnal parrots, which were once some of the country's most common birds, but now there are only 147 adults left. But under a new conservation scheme this year, 76 chicks have hatched, and 60 of them are expected to reach adulthood. And finally, metal boxes that have been floating around the ocean since 1931 have accidentally created a record of the history of plastics in the ocean. Now, they're designed to catch plankton, but they're getting plastics caught up too. The boxes, they first caught a plastic bag near Ireland in 1965, but you can imagine, in the last 50 years, they've caught many more microplastics since. That is it for this week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. So you've got a few things to do before next week when we chat again. If you've got a sciencey question that you want answered by a proper expert on this show, you need to let me know what it is right now over on Apple Podcasts. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on there. Leave us 5 stars. Drop your name so I can say hello. In the bottom, there's a comment box. That's where you leave your question. Also, if you would, please get over to BritishPodcastAwards.com/vote and vote for the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Who knows? We might get a shiny, sparkly, golden award prize to stick on in the toilet. And it shows, really, that you could be some of the greatest fans ever. Also, by the way, while you're on Apple Podcasts, it's one of the best places that you can hear all the fantastic shows that we do at Fun Kids. You've heard some today. There are many more out there. You can also hear them on the free Fun Kids app at funkidslive.com. And remember, Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. You can find us on your DAB digital radio at home. We're on that free Fun Kids app, and we're at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.